from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a 2006 study when researchers at the University of Minnesota determined that more than 47% of Americans would disapprove if their child married an atheist. Well, in survey after survey, we've seen more than 40% of Americans saying they consider atheists unfit for the presidency. And so our connection this hour is going to look at a term, secularism. Some people hear the word secularism and they think it means atheism. Some people hear the word secularism and they think it means anti-religious. My guest this hour wants to correct some of those ideas. His name is Ron Lindsay. He is the president of the Center for Inquiry, and he's the author of a new book called The Necessity of Secularism, Why God Can't Tell Us What to Do. He's on the line with us now. Ron Lindsay, welcome back to the program. Hi, Ron. Are we there?
Yes.
Oh, there you are. I can now hear you.
Okay.
How are you? Thanks for taking the time.
I'm fine. Looking forward to our discussion.
Well, and you know, I want to start in an uncomfortable place because, again, you make some very important distinctions between secularism and atheism. Your book makes the case that the best protection for religious freedom is secularism. But before we get there, I want to ask you about the Charlie Hebdo attacks in France. Your organization's been involved in free expression cases for years. What does the massacre there say to you?
What it says is that, unfortunately, there are all too many people in the world today that want to limit everyone's right to free expression. This was an outrageous act. Outrageous not just because several people were murdered, and obviously that was a horrible thing, but it represents an attack on one of our fundamental rights as human beings, and that's the right to express ourselves freely about any subject, whether it's a religious subject or a political subject or what have you. So, as I said, this was a horrible act, and I think people need to show a unity and solidarity and make it clear that this type of action will not be tolerated.
The Center for Inquiry is certainly familiar with free expression cases, and boy, fortunately, most don't end up in actual violence. But threats are common, aren't they, Ron?
They are. We do get threats from time to time. I've received some threats. Some other staff members have received threats. But that's part of what happens when you take controversial positions and when you don't pull any punches. And we do, one of the things we do here, one of the principles we live by is that no belief, whether it's a political belief, a scientific claim, or a religious belief, is immune from criticism. So we do offer, we think, careful and measured criticism, appropriate criticism of beliefs when we think they're unsupported. And some people don't like that. I think it's actually this attack and some of the threats we get, especially when we examine religion, actually shows the insecurity and weakness that some people have about their own beliefs, because that explains why they want to lash out and kind of silence the critics, is because they feel threatened by any sort of criticism.
When it comes to the Charlie Hebdo attacks, unfortunately, it's a zero-sum game in that it will either silence some expression for at least a little while, if not permanently, or there will be a resurgence in the face of this violence. And we've seen demonstrations across Europe, certainly across Paris, across the United States of solidarity. We have seen some news organizations, though certainly not all, reprinting the cartoons of Charlie Hebdo, etc. Do you think that this kind of violence will have a chilling effect on those who would engage in satire, or do you think that it will turn back in the faces of these attackers in terms of not only not stopping satire, but injuring their reputation in their own religious world?
Both. How's that for an answer? I think, unfortunately, there will be some news organizations that may be more hesitant now. I think some were hesitant before about making critical remarks about religion, especially pointed remarks that might border on satire. On the other hand, I think there still will be plenty of publications and individuals. Obviously, I would include our publications, Free Inquiry is our magazine, Principal Magazine, along with Skeptical Inquirer among them, who are not going to be intimidated by this, and who will continue to publish whatever we think is accurate and appropriate. In terms of how it's going to affect the reputation of these extremists, I don't think they're worried about that. Unfortunately, I guess I want to make a couple points here. One, it is important to keep in mind that these represent a very small minority of the Muslim population. Most Muslims obviously reject this type of violence. But that said, there is definitely a segment of the Islamic world that unfortunately, if they don't engage in terror themselves, passively support this type of thing. And that was, I happened to see some of the reaction on social media in the Islamic world, and sad to say, there were some people who indicated they approved this action. So there is a small, but nonetheless, significant portion of the Islamic world that supports this type of fundamentalism, and something to be aware of. And I don't really think they're that concerned about the reaction of the West, because, of course, they see the West as this, evil force that's trying to suppress their religious beliefs. So I'm not sure they're going to be that bothered. But that said, I think it is important for our own sake to make sure that we underscore the importance of these freedoms and to make sure that we continue to exercise them to show solidarity and to show that we're not going to be intimidated. I was very encouraged by the fact that the large portion of the population in Paris and even outside of Paris had that spontaneous demonstration yesterday. I think it showed a lot of courage, and it showed that I think many of the French people are standing behind these fundamental rights and are not going to be swayed by these violent actions.
In your book, The Necessity of Secularism, which is out now, you write that in parts of Europe, the UK especially, there's discussion about offering a kind of parallel legal system for religious factions, and specifically you write the following, quote, "Already in the United Kingdom, Sharia councils have been allowed to arbitrate disputes among Muslims. Although in theory the decisions of these councils must not conflict with British law, this is not always the case." You add that British lawyers have recently taken steps toward a parallel legal system specifically for Muslims, and you write that, quote, "We should do everything we can to avoid such an outcome." Why?
Because that will lead to a situation in which ultimately societies will be fractured along religious lines. And if one thing that history teaches us, that's very dangerous, because that will it may placate certain religious groups for a period of time, but ultimately it's going to create barriers between different people of different faiths. We're going to have essentially the ghettoization of the legal system, one law for this group, one law for another group, what have you, and that's going to make it much more difficult to have a unified society. So in the short term, it may please some people and, as I said, placate some of their concerns, but in the long term, it will lead to a breakup of society along religious lines, and that probably will unfortunately lead to more violence, more misunderstanding, as opposed to less violence.
My guest for the hour is Ron Lindsay, the CEO of the Center for Inquiry and the author of the new book, The Necessity of Secularism, Why God Can't Tell Us What to Do. If you want to join the conversation, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. Ron, you're an atheist, but you were raised to be religious, and you grew up quite religious, and you write that you're glad you did. Some atheists resent being raised religious, but you feel the opposite.
Right. I don't feel any resentment toward it. First of all, my parents, that's what they sincerely believed, and like most children, I was brought up to reflect the beliefs of my parents. At a certain point in time, I began to question that, and eventually I left religion, but I think it's helpful for me to kind of understand the religious perspective, to understand how people who are religious reason, and I think it helps ensure that I don't buy into some of the myths that atheists have about religious people. Just like religious people have some myths about atheists, some of them think we're immoral or evil or what have you because we don't believe in God. Some atheists believe that, oh, religious people, they're ignorant or stupid or what have you, and that's not the case. I mean, I certainly didn't think I was stupid when I was a young adult. I was just mistaken. And therefore, I think it gives me, number one, a bit more respect for religious people than I might otherwise have. And number two, it helps me kind of understand their frame of mind. And I think that's important to enhance dialogue and respectful conversation.
When you were a devoutly religious person in your late teens, early 20s, did you truly believe that God was communicating directly with you?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think that's certainly common for many believers. I thought that, you know, when I was praying, God was answering. I recognize now that those were simply thoughts in my head that, for whatever reason, resonated with me, and I thought this was God speaking to me. But that was an important experience for me, and it was a vivid experience. And again, I think having had that experience, having held that belief, it helps me to understand why religion is important for many people. They think it is a vehicle for communicating with this, essentially this friend they have, you know, this powerful being. I think that, as I said, certainly colors their outlook on life, and I understand that. And again, although I don't share that belief anymore, I understand why it's important for believers, and I'm actually okay with that. As I point out in my book is not about preaching atheism. I mean, there are books out there that talk about, you know, why belief in God is not, you know, supported by the evidence, what have you. In my book, I'm not concerned about that. What I am concerned about is that we can reason together as a people in a democracy, regardless of our religious beliefs.
And we're going to get to some of the core of what makes up the necessity of secularism, Ron Lindsay's new book, in a moment. Let me get our first phone call. This is Molly in Brighton. Go ahead, Molly.
Yes, I can't hear you very well. Good afternoon.
Go ahead.
I'd like to say to point to two. First of all, it was horrible what has happened, inexcusable and absolutely wrong. If these jihadists really liked Islam, they would do good deeds instead of bad ones to show their religion off in a good light. So that's one thing. Secondly, I cannot help but compare what happened to the doctors who were killed because of abortion at the abortion clinic several years ago. You remember? That's one thing also to consider.
Molly, thanks for the call. And Ron, to her point there about why wouldn't they do good things in the name of Islam, I know that this is a sensitive point, but there's a real debate about whether they think they were following the tenets of their religion, right?
Right. There's a debate, and obviously there are many Muslims who would say, well, no, they're following a perverted version of Islam. But here's the problem. And this would be true for, you know, and there are some Christian extremists also, although fewer in number, and Jewish extremists, again, fewer in number, for other reason, and there are historical reasons for it. Islamic terrorism and extremism now is more of a problem than extremism from other religion. But in any event, who's to say who has the authentic interpretation of the Quran or the Hadith, you know, which are the sayings about Muhammad? The problem is, no religion has the internal resources to say who is right when it comes to interpreting religious texts, because religious texts, by their very nature, are open to dispute. And that's just proven historically. I mean, there have been countless numbers of disputes about how to interpret Scripture. So if you try within a religion to say, oh, this person has a wrong view of religion, they can come back and say, well, no, my view is right. I mean, yeah, you say that's your interpretation of the Quran. Well, I have a different interpretation of the Quran. You know, you say you have this interpretation of a biblical passage. I have a different interpretation of a biblical passage. At the end of the day, there is no rational way to arbitrate between those different interpretations.
Right, and again, that is the underpinning of why Ron is arguing for secularism and why secularism does protect religious freedom. We'll get there in a second with my guest Ron Lindsay, the author of The Necessity of Secularism, a new book. Ron, you think we have arrived at a moment unique to human history in regards to the makeup of the human population's belief in various deities. What makes this moment unique?
What makes this moment unique is that for the first time in human history, in many countries, large segments of the population are now non-religious, voluntarily non-religious. So that's, I make a distinction between what's happening now and the kind of top-down atheism that was forced on people in some communist countries. Nowadays, it's people in Western countries, especially Europe, but also increasingly in the United States, people are coming to their own conclusions about the existence of God, and many people are coming to the conclusion, well, there's not enough evidence to support that belief, and I'm not going to believe it anymore. This is really unprecedented. I mean, atheism was virtually non-existent, except for some, you know, philosophers and thinkers, up until the late 18th century, and even then, it remained very much an isolated type of belief. It's really only been in the last 50 to 60 years that you've had significant portions of the population in some countries adopting the view that there is no God. So this creates a dynamic that didn't exist before. I think it's safe to say, at least for the next several generations, we are going to have, at least in the developed world, a mixed population. That is, we're going to have a substantial portion of the population that is non-religious, and a substantial portion that is religious, and then even within that religious segment, there's much more diversity than there was in the past. So that in the United States, of course, now we don't only have Christians, but also Jews, and a significant portion of the population is Muslim, and adherents also of some Eastern religions. So it creates a much more religiously pluralistic society than we've had in the past.
And again, the part of what you're saying is not that this is a trend that's going to eventually create a largely, mostly 80, 90, 95% atheist world. You think it's part of the human condition that that's not likely to happen anytime soon, if ever. And so that means that there must be sort of a coexistence, a co-creation of legislative policy that works for society that is mixed when it comes to religious belief or non-belief. But at the same time, and you address this in the book, aren't you always going to have people who say, I'm an elected office, I'm religious, the way I vote, the way I create legislation and policy has to be guided by a religious compass. It's part of my core.
Yes, you are going to have people like that. And my book, in part, is addressed to these individuals. And I recognize not everyone's going to be persuaded, you know, by the arguments of the book. I mean, no book has 100% success in trying to persuade people that, oh, this is the correct argument. I'm hoping to make some headway by making people step back and recognize that, look, your religious precepts obviously are meaningful to you, but if you try to form public policy on that basis, you're going to be shutting out of the public policy discussion anyone who doesn't accept your religious precepts, which increasingly now, given our diversity, means you're shutting out large segments of the population. So ultimately, at the end of the day, you're not going to have a true discussion about public policy. You're simply going to have, you know, you trying to impose your beliefs on others. And of course, if everyone mirrors that type of attitude, we're going to have, you know, people trying to impose Christian beliefs, people trying to impose Muslim beliefs, people who are non-religious trying to impose their beliefs. And again, that's not, I think, the proper way forward. Not if we want a functioning democracy where we have as unified a population as possible. So, I know some people are going to be resistant to this idea, but in my book, I try to show really the only way forward for a democracy is to have our discussions about public policy conducted in secular terms.
Ron Lindsay, my guest, the author of the new book, The Necessity of Secularism, Why God Can't Tell Us What to Do. If you want to call the program and join the conversation, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Ron, when you talk about secularism, as I open the show with, there are people who will think it either means atheism or anti-religion, etc. Define secularism, first of all.
Sure. In my view, I think secularism has two critical components. One component is the familiar principle of separation of church and state, which, you know, at least in the United States, is reflected in our Constitution, especially in the First Amendment. If that principle is followed, then we would have a secular government. But in my view, a secular government, although it's necessary for secularism, isn't sufficient for secularism. To have a truly secular society, we also need a society in which Religious doctrine plays no role in shaping public policy, and discussions about public policy are carried out entirely in secular terms. So that's what I mean by secularism. Essentially, when people engage in democratic discourse, they phrase their arguments in terms that are understandable to everyone, and that means they must be phrased in secular terms.
When it comes to that term, you address in your book the fact that devoutly religious people are often concerned about the phrase, or they view it as a pejorative. Why do you think that is?
Because I think it is confused, and this is why, as you indicate, I try to point out in the book that secularism is not the same thing as atheism. I think, unfortunately, in part because there are some conservative politicians and conservative religious groups that try to scare their constituency and try to get them animated, so they talk about the dangers of secularism, and when they do that, they're really equating secularism with atheism, and they're different things. Secularism is essentially a political or ethical philosophy, if you will. Atheism is a metaphysical belief. It's a belief about what's out there in the universe. Atheists think there's no God. Obviously, religious people think there is a God. Well, fine, that's a belief about the ultimate, constituents of the universe. Doesn't necessarily entail any particular view about how we should conduct our politics and our moral reasoning. There are many religious people, fortunately, who are secularists, who accept the fact that, I have these religious beliefs, but they should not play any role in public policy discussions. And as I said, that's a good thing. And so you can. There's no inconsistency between being religious, between being believing in God, whether you're a Christian, a Jewish, or Muslim, and accepting secularism, which, again, I emphasize, it's not a belief about what's out there in the universe. Rather, it's a belief about how we should talk to each other when we're discussing public policy.
Jake writes to the program the following, quote, "The argument that secularism protects religious rights is an invalid one because it doesn't protect the rights of those extremists. Obviously, it can't. What this boils down to is how to legislate morality. This is an issue that is utterly impossible to ever get a unanimous consensus on with even basic issues. So while I agree with secularism, there is no action path forward here that eliminates extremism. It's built into human nature on literally a biological level." Ron?
Well, you're right. I mean, there's no viewpoint, whether it's a viewpoint in favor of secularism or a viewpoint in favor of anything that you can mention, that's going to get unanimous consent from everyone. And I don't think we need that. What we do need is ultimately the vast majority of people to accept secularism, and I think that's possible. Because again, if people come to understand that accepting secularism is not a threat to their religious beliefs, they can believe what they want to believe and still be secular, then I think many people will begin to accept secularism, especially when they see the logic of it. Is it going to eliminate extremism? No, but that's just a fact. I mean, that would be true of any political viewpoint. There are always going to be some extremists who are going to reject it. But to return to an early point that was raised in that question, it does protect religious people, and I think you'll find that's true. It's validated by history. Countries that have been more secular have actually given much more religious freedom to groups than countries that have established religions. So, in fact, the United States, interestingly enough, which was the first secular state because we were the first country to expressly recognize the importance of separation of church and state, we are actually more religious than many other developed countries, and we have more religions. This country has given birth to many more religions than other countries. You think of all the religions that have originated in the United States, Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, Christian Scientists, Scientologists, the list goes on, and that's because we allow people to explore these ideas on their own. We respect freedom of conscience and freedom of religion, and all that's possible within the framework of a secular state and a secular society, which allows people to form their own private beliefs about religious matters. What secularism says, though, is that those beliefs must remain private. You can't use those beliefs as a justification for imposing your religious doctrines on others.
So to be clear, Ron, if your idea, if your sort of, dream's the wrong word, if your vision of this, of a secular society is to sort of unfold, it requires a lot of people who are religious to embrace secularism, who aren't currently embracing secularism, right?
That is correct. Some, as I said, some religious people do embrace secularism already and to no ill effects on their religious beliefs. But it will require more people to accept it, because I think there is still some resistance out there, in part a result of this confusion that secularism means atheism, which it doesn't. So we have to overcome that. But as I said, there'll still be some resistance. And I think to overcome that resistance, we just have to rely on logic and argument and show that really this is the only way forward. Because the alternative to secularism, which again means that when we talk about public policy, we discuss it in secular terms, not using religious precepts, is that one religious group will try to impose their religious views on others. And I think, I hope people realize that's a recipe for disaster. Because I mean, at the end of the day, that means, well, gee, whether my religion prevails or not means, you know, whether I can mobilize my forces and get them to the polls on time, or worse, whether through some sort of intimidation, I can prevent other religious groups from prevailing. That's not the way to have a peaceful, unified democracy.
On Twitter, Josh writes to us, "Forgive me, but I thought we were already living in a secular country."
We are to some extent. So as I said, remember, there are two components of secularism. One is the principle of separation of church and state, which unfortunately sometimes has been more honored in the breach than the observance, but you know, overall, I think we're doing an acceptable job at that level. But beyond that, I think far too often our debates about public policy continue to be framed, both by politicians and by members of the general public, in religious terms. And that often results in an impasse. You can see this in debates about, you know, some current controversial issues. Same-sex marriage, for example, stem cell research, abortion, other areas, people will, you know, put forward an argument. They'll say, well, I don't believe in same-sex marriage because the Old Testament says that relations between men, sexual relations between men, is an abomination. Well, if that's the position you're taking, then that's kind of the end of the conversation, isn't it? I mean, you can't argue with someone's faith. So if all they're putting forward as an argument is their interpretation of a holy text, that really is meaningless, except, you know, for those people who share that person's religious viewpoint. If you want to engage others in a meaningful dialogue about the pros and cons of any public policy, you have to leave your religious precepts behind. So when you say we're living in a secular state already, as I said, at least to some extent, we do honor the principle of separation of church and state, in the sense that there is no explicit religious control of government. On the other hand, as I said, far too often our debates are carried out through use of religious doctrines, and I think that inhibits discussion, inhibits a meaningful dialogue, and if we want a truly democratic society, we need to get away from that.
The book is called The Necessity of Secularism, Why God Can't Tell Us What to Do. Ron Lindsay, the author, is on the line with us for this hour. It is a svelte read, and I don't say that as a pejorative, Ron. I say that it's very focused. I think you can read it in 3 hours or less, which was a credit to the author.
No, I try to be concise, especially as I get older, and I'm 62 now. I appreciate brevity. I like people to get to the point, and some people mentioned to me, they said that there's no repetition. It isn't. You know, I have several related arguments to make, and I make them, and that's the case.
The most flowery part is the cover, is kind of what I think. The book's called The Necessity of Secularism, and I'd love to hear from our listeners this hour. Do you agree with the notion that we could create a secular society and the majority of people who are religious would accept those terms. Do you think we currently have a separation of church and state, or are you struggling with even that idea? And I also want to get to Mary's comment that just came in. Mary is saying that we are inherently a Christian nation, and that why would we move in that direction? We'll get Ron's comment on that after the break. You can call the program, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI right here in Rochester, 263-9994. The conversation on secularism continues in 60 seconds right here on member-supported public radio. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, we'll have a panel that discusses the Charlie Hebdo attacks and the question of protecting free expression here and around the world. Then we look at the effort to get more urban children the financial aid they need to go to college. It's an effort at FAFSA, providing aid to students. That's all coming up Friday on Connections.
Millions of people find unpaid doctor's bills on their credit reports and go, what?
They thought their insurance company paid for it. They didn't know there was a balance due. Sometimes the insurance company did pay for it, but they paid for it late and it had already gone to collection.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, medical debt that lives forever. Next time on Marketplace, it's from APM.
This evening at 6:30.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Ron Lindsay's on the line with us, the author of the book, The Necessity of Secularism. Ron, I don't know if you know Peter Boghossian. Do you know Peter?
Yes, I know Peter. Sure.
Yeah, his book that came out about a year ago, A Manual for Creating Atheists, which is actually not as militant as the title sounds, does bring up an interesting idea. And I wonder if it plays into, it certainly doesn't play again into the core of your book, but I'm curious to know what you think about his idea. And his idea is that we have treated the notion of religion as a discussion topic, as a third rail topic, for far too long. As in, you just don't talk about it. Peter wants people in the line at the bank, in the line at the supermarket, walking down the street. He wants people to have that conversation they meet with strangers in a way of understanding their epistemology. How do they construct their beliefs and dive right into it? Is that too aggressive for you, or do you think that we need to throw out the notion of religion as a third rail and start really talking about what we believe and why we believe it?
I certainly think if people are going to make claims about religion, and people do all the time, that essentially is an invitation to a discussion, and people who may disagree with their perspective should be feel free to question that, so that, you know, it's not uncommon that people say, yes, I believe in God and I believe God answered my prayers. And if in fact they're putting that forward as something that perhaps they want others to believe, then, you know, atheists or other skeptics should feel free to engage in a discussion. And we should, I hope, reach a point in our society where we can do that without creating any animosity. On the other hand, I guess one thing where I may slightly differ with Peter is I get the sense that he would be interested in doing what, I guess for lack of a better term, I'd call missionary activity. He would actually like to see atheists take the initiative maybe sometimes and, you know, bring up the discussion of religion with people. I'm not saying that's bad. Again, it depends on the context where it happens. But I guess I'm less concerned about that. Again, I'm not particularly concerned what someone's, you know, individual religious beliefs are, provided they recognize that those beliefs, you know, shouldn't be imposed on others. And again, when we come to reason together as a people about what our policy should be, we shouldn't, you know, inject religious beliefs into that discussion. If people are willing to do that is, keep their religious beliefs private, I'm really not that concerned whether they believe there's a God, if it's a Trinity, or that Muhammad was the prophet, or if they believe the Jews were the chosen people, or whatever it is. I think they're mistaken, but people are mistaken about a lot of things. The question is that mistaken belief causing harm? If it's not causing harm, then I don't feel that much incentive to go out and try to persuade people that they might be mistaken.
David in Rochester, you're on with Ron Lindsay. Go ahead, David.
Yes, I would. Could you possibly address where it comes from? As the caller before said, that this is a Christian nation. Second, thing I would really like to address is, maybe you could address, is the movement across several states to create state legislatures and their equivalents of what we have, the regions in New York, to revise books that are read in the schools, i.e. history books, the creationist movement, and all that. If you could address that, I would appreciate it, and I'll take your comments offline.
David, thanks. Ron, let's start with the second part of his question, because he's referring again to Mary's comment that came in right before the break. I'm going to get to that in a moment, but he's asking you, the latter part of his comment was about state legislatures or regents boards that are that have a hand in school reading, and his concern about, say, creationism.
Well, right. I mean, there is an unfortunate movement in a number of states to inject religious doctrines into the classroom. Often it's veiled now because the Supreme Court has made it clear that you can't put creationism explicitly into the classroom. So there are various ways to try to get that in subtly. There's legislation saying that teachers in biology courses can open up discussion about competing theories without, mentioning creationism or what have you. Again, it's very important to look at the exact wording of legislation to see exactly what is being proposed. But there's no mistake that the creationists haven't given up the battle. They know they can't win outright by imposing creationism or even putting creationism in as an alternative, but they're doing whatever they can to undercut the teaching of evolution. Obviously, that's wrong from my perspective, because that is trying, very subtly in some cases, but still nonetheless trying to make an effort to put religious doctrine into the school system, and the school system should be teaching subjects from a secular perspective. I mean, whatever the science shows is what the science teacher should be teaching, not, engaging in essentially implicitly religious teachings. And it goes, of course, beyond creationism. I mean, there are, especially now, there's, I think in Texas, they recently had school board meetings that approved textbooks that have a very distorted view of history, unfortunately, that, again, are reflecting a religious perspective, not a true, accurate, reading of history, but rather a reading of history that's been influenced by religious doctrine. And that's just incorrect on a number of different levels.
Before I get back to the phones, his other part of the question, Ron, was about Mary's comment that came in right before the break. Mary writes, "We are a Christian nation as constructed by our founders. Why would they support a move towards secularism?"
Well, with all due respect to Mary, I think she's mistaken. I think a objective view of history and of the founding of this country demonstrates really beyond any reasonable doubt that the founders wanted a secular nation in the sense of having a clear separation of church and state. The Christian nation argument, as put forward by a number of people, relies on cherry-picking certain facts and fallacious reasoning. What's striking to me, and I've read a number of books now by Christian nation advocates, is they often refer to what happened in colonial times. And it's undoubtedly true that some of the colonies, especially Massachusetts, for example, were run essentially as theocracies. But what happened in the colonies doesn't reflect what the founders wanted when they started this nation. The document that sets up how this nation is to be governed is the Constitution. And what's striking about the Constitution is that there's not one word in there about how the government is based on Christian principles or based on God or what have you. We have a godless Constitution. There's nothing in there about religion. In fact, in the body of the Constitution itself, there's only one article that addresses religion, and that's in negative terms. Article 6 of the Constitution indicates that no religious test shall ever be required for public office under the United States. So the founders, if they wanted to establish a Christian nation, they must have been very forgetful when they drafted the document, because there's no reference to Jesus, to basing government on Christian principles or anything else. Rather, they set up a framework for government that was entirely secular. And then if you look at, it's striking to me if I can just explain a bit, one of the ironies is that one of the groups that, you know, puts forward this Christian nation argument, there are many members of the Tea Party who put forward this argument. And what's ironic about that is Tea Party advocates often say they wanted limited government. And I understand that. Well, the founders actually did establish a limited government. You know, if you look at Article 1, Section 8, it sets forth the powers of Congress. In other words, what laws Congress can pass. And there's, you know, only 20 or 25 different subjects that Congress can pass laws on. There's nothing in there that indicates Congress has any power over religious bodies, and there's certainly no indication that religious bodies have any right to influence Congress. Congress set up a civil, secular government that has no power whatsoever on religious matters, and vice versa. You know, there's no indication that religious doctrine should have any influence on government matters. So they set up a clear separation of church and state. This is not a Christian nation. Many of the founders, I think, were Christian. Many people at the time were Christian. But that actually just goes to prove my point that people can be religious and still believe in secularism. And that was the perspective, fortunately, of many of our founders.
Bill, thanks for calling. You're on with author Ron Lindsay.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Since we're getting close to the end, I'm just going to make one point. I think that there's a very clear analogy between the ending of white supremacy in the United States and the ending of Christian supremacy in the United States. The Constitution originally actually embedded in it was white supremacy, with slaves being three-fifths of a human being. And the country was clearly founded on the doctrine of white supremacy. Many of the founders held slaves, etc. And in the 50s and 60s and 70s, as white supremacy was being questioned, the attitudes that we had of people, especially in the South, was that this nation was founded on white supremacy, and what's the problem? This is what the founders believed in. And the nature of the arguments and the attitudes that we're seeing today as Christian supremacy is being questioned are, just obviously analogous with the questions that were raised regarding white supremacy. I'd be interested in your comments.
Thanks, Bill. Go ahead, Ron. Ron, are you there?
Yeah, right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so to comment on that question those observations, I'm not sure I would accept the analogy. First of all, I don't think it's technically correct that the country was founded on white supremacy, although I certainly, you know, recognize that African Americans were treated, many of them were slaves, not all of them, because some had free status. To some extent, it was also founded on or reflected the attitudes about male supremacy. Both those perspectives obviously changed during the course of the 19th century. It actually took a little longer to change the perspective on women and give them, equal political rights. But I don't think it was really founded, as I said before, on the notion of Christian supremacy. Again, much of the nation was Christian. We were much more religiously homogeneous at the time of the founding than we are now. But I think most of the founders had enough foresight to realize that we needed to have a secular government, not a Christian government. The one thing I think, kind of going off that question, which I find interesting, is when we're speaking about issues such as civil rights and women's emancipation, which clearly were major issues in the history of this country, the move, first of all, to abolish slavery, the movement to get emancipation for women, and then, of course, in the 50s and 60s, to get full civil rights for African Americans. What's interesting is, although nowadays you'll find some people saying, oh, religious groups were in the forefront of the battle for abolition, what have you, actually, on any issue that you can take in the history of this country, you'll find religious groups on both sides. So that when people were debating slavery, you had people who were supporting slavery quoting the Bible and abolitionists who were quoting the Bible. When there was an argument about women's rights, you had people who opposed women's rights quoting the Bible and people who were in favor of women's rights quoting the Bible. So same thing with civil rights. There were actually a number of churches in the South, the Southern Baptists in particular, who were in favor of segregation. To me, that just shows the impossibility of basing public policy on religion and scripture and religious texts, because they're so subject to interpretation depending on one's religious perspective, they don't lend themselves to any sort of meaningful dialogue about, well, what are the consequences of this particular public policy or not? Religious texts, at the end of the day, are ultimately malleable, meaning that you can interpret them any way that you want, and history shows they have been interpreted in contradictory ways. So as I said, that underscores my point that if we want to have a productive dialogue about public policy issues, we need to embrace secularism.
John, go ahead.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Ron. Ron, is it true that there are no atheists in foxholes?
No, absolutely false. There have been many atheists in foxholes.
Ask Christopher Hitchens.
How do you know, though? Were you ever in a foxhole?
I was in a foxhole temporarily, although I would not put forward my...
In battle?
No.
Okay.
A fake battle.
Tongue-in-cheek comment.
Yeah.
But, you know, our founders, although I know a lot of our founders were not that religious, but they did believe in the Judeo-Christian beliefs and principles. But you know, one question for you. When the ACLU throws these lawsuits against Ten Commandments being in courthouses and, you know, that type of thing, or the major scenes being barred in certain cities or villages, where do you stand on that issue?
Well, we take a look at cases on a case-by-case basis, because they're often fact-specific. I think in general, though, our organization would be opposed to certainly any new monuments or new displays going up featuring the Ten Commandments, because that is an inherently religious document.
So you would be in favor of a pre-existing non-conforming use or something like that? That it's pre-existing,
if it's been there a while, you would be okay with that? It depends on the context. There was a case before the Supreme Court not long ago, I guess it's been a decade now, whether the Ten Commandments monuments on Texas State Capitol grounds, and the grounds were large and they had like 50 different monuments. It's not like we favor Ten Commandments monuments, but there I think the case is somewhat weaker for removing that monument, whereas the companion case that was decided by the Supreme Court at the same time involved a new display actually right in a courthouse of the Ten Commandments, and the Supreme Court, I think, quite rightly found that was unconstitutional, because it essentially, I mean, the Ten Commandments, I think, unquestionably, it's a religious document. And in fact, the first four commandments or so relate to religious duties, not to any real moral obligations. So, we don't think it's a good idea to have the Ten Commandments put in public spaces.
Lynn, you're on with Ron Lindsay. Go ahead, Lynn.
Well, you know, people have looked at the social scientists and psychologists. When you try to change by persuasion someone's core beliefs, for instance, religion, by counterfactual evidence, they reject you. So there's another way to be persuasive. It's utilitarian, but, you know, we have a government where it's divided off from religion. We look at the rest of the world where there is unceasing bloodshed from religious disagreements, all over the world. And even though the Islamic attack in France was only in the name of religion and wasn't truly an Islamic act, it was an act by terrorists, the one way to persuade is to show that this is the genius of our founders. We haven't had that kind of bloodshed over religious ideology, over religious texts. And that's the most persuasive argument, is that it was an act of genius. You can keep your religious beliefs. You don't have to persuade people that their core Christian beliefs are somehow limited or not generalizable. you affirm their beliefs, but you simply show them that they are private, that they don't have to interfere with government. And we're saved from so much bloodshed. So I think that's the most persuasive argument, is that it's kept our country relatively peaceful.
What do you think, Ron?
I agree with you, actually, and I make that argument in my book when I talk about, as you point out, the wisdom of the founders. I mean, that's precisely what they wanted to avoid because they had the experience of all the sectarian wars in Europe and, of course, also in the early colonies, and that's one reason they wanted to make sure that we had a government that kept out of religious matters and that kept religion out of government matters. And I think overall we have done better. There actually have been some violent episodes in the history of the country. There were anti-Mormon riots, in the 1800s. There were some anti-Catholic riots. But overall, we have done better than many other countries. And I think the key for keeping a lid on religious violence has been our tradition of separating church and state. I just think we need to go a bit further in the sense that we need to make sure that we keep religion out of public policy discussions as well.
Ron, 30 seconds. I suspect we will get to a time when someone can run for a major office, a federal office, president, perhaps, when saying that you're an atheist is not a deal breaker. Right now it is. That would be a deal breaker, I think. How long until we see that sort of acceptable in the public eye?
I'm hoping we can see it within a generation. Some people would say I'm too pessimistic about that, but I think that's a realistic thing. I think people are becoming more tolerant, and also there is an increase in the non-religious population. So I'll predict we'll have an atheist president in 2030. How's that?
Ron, the phone never stopped ringing this hour, and shows you the interest in the work that Ron is doing. The book is called The Necessity of Secularism, Why God Can't Tell Us What to Do. Ron Lindsay, the author, he's the CEO of the Center for Inquiry, and we appreciate your time this hour, not only talking to us here on Connections, but answering a lot of questions and comments from our listeners. Ron, thank you.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Ron Lindsay, book out now. Thanks to all of our callers. These 2 hours, and it has been a packed 2 hours, a great Thursday here. Thank you for listening. Val, Dave Campo, back behind the glass. Probably the worst engineer, but my favorite person in the building. I'm mostly kidding, Dave. It's a great day. Have a great day, everybody. I'm Evan Dawson. This is Member Supported Public Radio.